Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation and Labor and Employment Law Practice Groups, was recorded on Wednesday, November 23, 2016, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's special Courthouse Steps telephone conference call. Today's call will provide a litigation update on the legal challenge to the Department of Labor's new overtime rule. My name is Nate Kazmarek. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today we welcome our experts, Lawrence Van Dyke, Solicitor General of Nevada, Jesse Panuccio, partner at Foley and Lardner, and Michael Hancock, of counsel at Cohen and Milstein. Today I will turn it over to Lawrence to get us started. Following our experts' opening remarks, we'll open the floor for audience questions, so please be thinking of those questions. Gentlemen, thank you for speaking with us. Lawrence, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Nate. This is Lawrence Van Dyke, and as Nate said, I'm the Solicitor General of Nevada, and we in the state of Nevada took the lead on a 21-state coalition that challenged the overtime rule, and we were interested. My boss, Attorney General Adam Laxalt, was interested and troubled by this rule for two reasons. One was its broad impact on businesses, especially many businesses in Nevada. But then as we talked with other states, we also heard about what an impact and what a burden it was going to be on states. So we got interested in the suit and ended up working on bringing a challenge and ended up having 20 other states joined us for a 21-state coalition. And we were joined with a separate lawsuit that was eventually consolidated that was private business interests also challenging the rule. And I'll just quickly outline the arguments that we brought in challenging the rule in federal district court in Texas, in the Eastern District of Texas. And that is, we had some arguments that were for the states only, and then we had broader arguments that were both the states and the private business plans. Now, our state-specific arguments, which really, I'll just mention them quickly and then move on because they weren't really the basis of the court's ruling. We did challenge the rule based on a sovereignty sort of 10th Amendment argument, challenging the Garcia decision that said that the Fair Labor Standards Act can apply to states. So we recognized, of course, that this federal district judge probably couldn't overrule U.S. Supreme Court precedent, so that was more of a reservation of argument, and it was pretty clear that the judge saw it as such. But along the same lines, we also made an argument, what do you call a clear statement argument, saying from the Gregory decision, arguing that if you're going to apply a rule like the FLSA to states, that you need to apply, there needs to be a clear statement of congressional intent before you can apply it, and so that basically the way we argued it was that flips the Chevron step two type of analysis from if it's arbitrary and capricious, where that normally would benefit a federal agency, that it actually would mean that you could not apply that type of an interpretation, a Chevron step two type interpretation to the states. We thought that was a really strong argument for the states. The judge Mazant, did not kind of dismiss that in just a paragraph. So that's one interesting aspect of this case. But one upshot of that was that because he did not, his decision didn't turn on that, we ended up with a ruling that did not just apply to the states, but also applied to the business plans, because the clear statement argument would only apply to the states. The other argument that we brought was a non-delegation type argument, and that was more just a I guess you call it sort of what we call sort of a pincher argument, in that we, to the extent that the federal government argued that, well, this is, we've got really, really, really broad delegation, and that's why you should defer to our delegation. We wanted to bring a non-delegation argument to say, if it's that broad, then there's a delegation problem. Of course, the judge didn't address that argument, given how he ruled. I will say, though, I guess, and then I won't talk anymore, I don't think about those claims, but the judge does give us a little shout out at the very end on the Garcia argument. He says, although the state plans have made a persuasive case that Garcia may have been implicitly overruled, the court is constrained to follow Garcia. So I guess if this ever made it to the U.S. Supreme Court, hopefully we could get five to agree with us on that. But moving on from the state-specific arguments, we also The broader arguments, the arguments that applied both to basically across the board to states, to state and local governments, as well as private entities, private employers, was we made a Chevron step one type statutory argument, and that was that the text of the FLSA doesn't permit the salary test at all. And this was a pretty ambitious argument, given that the Department of Labor has had a salary test for 75 years, but when in reading it, you know, we really came to the conclusion that it just doesn't permit a salary test, and so we argued that. And then we also argued that even if the FLSA does permit a salary test, and you know, perhaps maybe you could, you know, there were some issues about congressional acquiescence, that Congress over the past 75 years sort of acquiesced in there being a salary test. We argue that even if it does permit it, that it certainly doesn't permit a salary test like the salary test in the current rule that's been enjoined, that would trap a substantial number of EAP employees under the cutoff. And so, the private business plaintiffs, to be clear, didn't argue that the text of the FLSA doesn't permit a salary test at all. Their argument was more that it does permit one, but it doesn't permit one this high. And so we had some overlap, but some slightly different nuances to how we were arguing it in the case. And then we also both brought a Chevron Step 2 arbitrary and capricious challenge, saying that again, even if the FLSA, it was a lot like the second part of our Chevron Step 1 argument, that even if the FLSA does permit some salary test, it's arbitrary and capricious for the Department of Labor to impose a salary level test that traps a substantial number of EAP employees underneath their cutoff. So that we brought those two claims. We also brought, that was primarily our substantive claims. And of course, we had to show irreparable harm and public interest. And we also had some issues about the scope of the injunction. Should it be a national? Should this injunction be nationwide in scope? And should it only apply to the states that brought the challenge, the 21 states? And then the other question was whether or not we should apply to just states, or should it apply to private entities? Ultimately, the judge ruled for the states and the private entities on substantive grounds. He said we had a likelihood of prevailing. And one of the interesting issues is his analysis, it seems to me, does sort of turn on the fact that he agreed with us that the text of the FLSA doesn't really permit the salary test. Now, what's interesting about that is he does drop a footnote 2 of the decision that seems to reserve the question of whether you could have any salary test. So I actually think that the judge, you know, would maybe be open to a salary test as in the current rule, one that's very low and does not trap a substantial number of EAP employees. But he certainly was very concerned about a salary test that did trap a substantial number of EAP employees. And his rationale, and I'm sure Jesse and Michael may have some thoughts on this, but his rationale does seem to be that the salary test itself is inconsistent with the rule, an argument that the states made. I will also point out, I guess I sort of passed over this, but it was actually the states that brought a motion for a preliminary injunction in this case, and the private entities had brought a motion for an expedited summary judgment. So they all got consolidated, and the judge ended up ruling and granting a preliminary injunction across the board. So because of that, really the only issue before the court on some of the other preliminary injunction issues like irreparable harm and public interest balance harms really only involved the state and states. And I was a little bit surprised the federal government did push back and try to say that the states didn't have irreparable harm. I found that a little bit surprising because I thought, you know, the Department of Labor had itself acknowledged that it was going to cost over $100 million for state and local governments in the first year alone on this rule. Of course, you know, most of that money isn't money you'd never get back if the rule went into effect and then was later enjoined. And the other big issue was, of course, scope of the injunction. And the Department of Labor did argue that the injunction should be limited to just those states that had joined. You know, we responded that, as in a lot of these other cases, the immigration case, the persuader rule, some of these other cases that have been challenged recently that have been enjoined, that preliminary enjoined, that it should be enjoined nationally. It's a national rule. It would be very odd to have a balkanized rule where 21 states, you know, the rule didn't apply, but the other 26 or 29, it did. So the judge seemed to agree with us on that. And before I pass it over to Jesse and Michael, I'll just make a couple observations, sort of a boots on the ground of having been involved in this case from the beginning and being at the hearing. One, I guess I've already kind of made, and that is the clear statement rule. I'm really kind of surprised that that it got no traction with the court. The bad side of that was I thought it was a great argument, so personally I was disappointed. But the good side of that was that if the judge had agreed with us on the clear statement rule, I suppose maybe we might end up with a ruling that only applied to government entities. The other thing I'd like to point out is, as I noted before, the states and the business plaintiffs were consolidated together, and they were able to all sort of ride on the state's preliminary injunction motion. So that turned out to be a great thing, I think, because we ended up with an injunction of the rule nationally and in all respects. And then the last thing I'll just point out, this is just sort of a litigation observation, and that was, and this is mostly a takeaway from the hearing where we had a 3.5-hour hearing, a very, very active questioning. Obviously, a judge is very knowledgeable about all of this. And the things that seem to trouble the judge, Judge Mazant, the most is that it really troubled him that 4.2 million employees on December 21st were going to go, and I think this is the Department of Labor's own estimate, but 4.2 million were going to immediately, in the snap of a finger, go from being EAP employees to non-EAP employees. And the judge really saw this as sort of a very different approach to the salary level test in the past, where this was not something I remember seeing in the briefs, but he repeatedly characterized it as changing from more of a floor to a ceiling approach and having a salary level test. So that was one that seemed to be the biggest concern that he had. I also note that that he agreed with the state's argument that that the salary only test that basically what they had created was a salary only test for anybody making under $47,000, and that really troubled him. Ultimately, it seems like he sort of applied a real textualist approach to a Chevron Step 1 analysis and said, but I would hasten to add that it seems to me that he was tempered a little bit by a historical approach, and that I'm not sure that the judge, notwithstanding his text, would say that every salary level test was forbidden. I mean, that's why I think he dropped that footnote too. But any salary test that trapped a substantial number of EAP employees under the salary level, I think, would really concern this judge. So with that, I'll turn it over to our other two commentators for their thoughts. Thank you, guys.
Well, I think that comes to me. This is Jesse Panuccio with Foley & Lardner down in Miami today. Let me just start out by giving credit to the Federalist Society for organizing this so quickly and perhaps giving something interesting for folks in airports and on freeways today, headed out for Thanksgiving, something interesting to listen to. So thank you to the Federalist Society. And let me secondly just give some credit to Solicitor General Van Dyke and Attorney General Laxalt and all of the other attorneys general and solicitors general around the country who joined this suit. It was somewhat of a gambit, I think. If you talk to most attorneys in labor practice 6 months ago or over the summer, I think many of them would have predicted that the suit, while it may get headlines, probably didn't have a strong chance of getting a preliminary injunction and success on the merits, maybe on the elevator clause, where the department said that every few years the salary level would automatically increase. There's a notice and comment problem with that, but on the overall increase to the salary level, because that test had been around for 75 years, I think many were skeptical. And Solicitor General Van Dyke and his team really put together some excellent papers, as did the Chamber and NFIB side. So congratulations to them. Now the overtime rule is essentially on life support, and this is a very significant piece of President Obama's economic legacy, of his economic package. He, as everyone knows, supported and was never able to persuade Congress to pass an increase in the minimum wage, and many thought that this was a backdoor way of raising wages across the country. And so this is a major blow to that legacy, specifically on the economic front. And then further, it's a continued pushback from the federal courts on what many have felt has been agency and executive overreach during this administration. And interestingly, this appointee, this judge, is an appointee of President Obama. So it's not as if you can even characterize this as Republican-appointed judges pushing back on executive action of a Democratic president. So another interesting wrinkle sort of just from an observer's point of view on this. I want to talk a little bit. Lawrence went through the merits, so I want to talk a little bit about the economics of this and then also where might we go from here. From an economic standpoint, individual businesses are obviously jubilant today that the cost of this is not going to come down upon them, at least not right now, as long as this nationwide injunction is in place. I will tell you, prior to my role, my joining Foley and Lardner, I was essentially the labor secretary here in Florida. And we, when I was still at the department, opposed this rule when it came out in draft form, precisely because we were worried about the economic impact it would have on the state. And of the thousands of comments that the Labor Department received when the rule was in draft form, one of them was ours, the Florida Department of Economic Opportunities comment. And we had our economists really look at what the Labor Department economists had said about the rule, and we found, and this goes toward what ultimately would be the arbitrary and capricious challenge in the case, but we found that the estimates of the economic impact of this rule were grossly misstated, just to give you some sense of it. And the final numbers changed a bit when they adopted a final rule, but the Obama administration was estimating at that time when it was a draft rule, what we found is that they overestimated the number of workers who would be brought into this rule by about 195,000 people in Florida, but they underestimated the cost very significantly. We found that the cost to businesses in Florida would be $1.7 billion, and the administration found that the total cost nationwide would be $2.08 billion. So what we were finding is that 82.7% of the DOL's entire national estimate would occur right in Florida. So something had to be wrong with the numbers. And indeed, when you divided the estimate of employers that they said would be affected by the rule and then the total cost, what you came out to was about $6 a week per worker, or less than 1 hour of minimum wage per week. So, you know, our view was something was wrong with the numbers, or the rule was going to be totally ineffective in doing what President Obama said, which was bringing more people, lower-paid workers, into the middle class. The two could not be reconciled, and so we were deeply skeptical of the rule and opposed it. And now, at least as long as this injunction is in place, those economic harms will be avoided. The other interesting thing to note about this, and I should have said this earlier, just on the merits of the ruling, I think as we think about Justice Scalia's passing and who will replace him on the bench, if you look at this ruling, it is one that would have made him proud in terms of its methodology. It is a textualist ruling from start to finish. You will see in the middle of the ruling, when the judge determines at Chevron step one that the rule, the overtime rule, violates the plain meaning of the Fair Labor Standards Act, the judge turns to nothing other than dictionaries that were around at the time of the enactment of the Fair Labor Standards Act. So there is no discussion of committee reports or floor statements or general purposes of what the FLSA might be trying to accomplish. It is an analysis of the plain words of the FLSA and what those plain words meant at the time. So just from a procedural standpoint, it is interesting to note the approach that the judge took. The other note I would just make is where do we go from here, and what should businesses be thinking about? For those of you on the call who are labor lawyers or in-house counsel who might be thinking about what to do from here, the number one piece of advice I would offer is pay attention right now. This is a dynamic, fluid situation. We have now a nationwide injunction from a single federal district court. There are some people who are speculating that the U.S. DOL will immediately go to the Fifth Circuit and try to get a stay and then go from there. And so you could have a situation unfolding over the Thanksgiving weekend, over the holiday season, in which the operative rules for businesses might change. And that's compounded by the fact that the Obama administration tried to rush this rule into place. They did not time it so that it would marry up with normal fiscal years or calendar years. They wanted to get it promulgated in early May to hopefully avoid the Congressional Review Act, which I'll talk about in a second, and then to have it in place before the administration changed over. So it is a fluid situation. Many businesses had already, going into the Thanksgiving holiday, had already been prepared to make this payroll change on December 1st, and now each of them will have to decide, based on the facts on the ground for them, what other, you know, what expectations they've set for their employees, what to do now. And so it is imperative that they just continue to pay attention. And the other thing that I've seen is that it's important to tell businesses and clients other issues they may have under the Fair Labor Standards Act, such as their baseline classifications, are not affected by this injunction. And there has been a lot of confusion out there. And part of that is because this rule really sweeps across. I mean, it hits government agencies, it hits nonprofits, small businesses, big businesses. And so there were many that simply were not ready for this, and now the injunction adds extra confusion. So it really is something to keep aware of. And the last thing I'll just note is, so what happens from here with an appeal or with the new administration? You know, my sense of it is appealing to the Fifth Circuit is going to be, or being in the Fifth Circuit will be a friendly place for Solicitor General Van Dyke and that side of this case, and a not-so-welcome forum for the federal government, just based on recent past. Moreover, I think if the court simply looks at the equities of this situation, they're going to be aware of the millions of businesses around the country that are affected and that might be seriously negatively affected by this continuing change in what they need to do with their payroll systems. And that may weigh on the side of the court simply doing nothing until the Trump administration comes in and decides where they want to go from a regulatory perspective. And on that front, I believe the rule went into place on May 23rd because the USDOL felt that there would be 60 legislative days before then and the end of this year when Congress gaveled out, which would mean that the Congressional Review Act would not apply. And for those who don't know, the Congressional Review Act is a 1996 law, part of the Contract with America, that said for agency rules that are promulgated within 60 legislative days, Congress can pass through both houses a resolution of disapproval, and if the president signs it, then the rule would be repealed. But that 60 legislative days is very important. Oh, well, the important piece is that the Congressional Review Act has a procedure to allow the Senate to get around the filibuster. And so what it means is if you don't have a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate, you can repeal rules and the filibuster won't be effective. If you get outside of that 60-day window, the filibuster can be effective. Most people thought earlier this year that the overtime rule would be insulated from CRA review, but I have seen recently, and others have, that it looks like the legislative calendar has worked out, and if they gavel out in time, the overtime rule may actually be subject to CRA review. If that is the case, then the cleanest thing for the new Congress and the new administration might be for a resolution of repeal to be signed by President Trump, and then all of this litigation and these issues would go away. So plenty more to say about this, but I think I'll leave it there and pass it over, and then also we'll, of course, have questions at the end, I assume. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Michael Hancock, and I want to thank both Lawrence and Nate for such Jesse for such a concise and informative overview of this litigation. And we'll try not to trot on ground that they've already covered, but I just have a couple of observations from sort of the plaintiff side of this. And frankly, from my experience at Department of Labor, where I worked until last year, there's a couple of things that strike me about this decision that I think are important to note. Even though the judge tried to somehow limit this decision in footnote 2, I don't know how you can read this decision without reaching the conclusion that, in his view, there can be no minimum salary level if the duties test is met. And so I think what he did was read out of this this exemption 75 years of a three-prong approach to whether or not the exemption applies: one, duties; two, salary basis; and three, salary level. If you don't have a minimum salary level, then the salary basis goes away and all that's left is duties. And that's a pretty radical decision given the 75 years of history, and given that Congress has from time to time revisited 213A1. I don't know, frankly, how that's going to survive on appeal when it's upsetting a donkey cart that's been in existence for 75 years. So it's going to be interesting to see what the Court of Appeals does when they're faced with this decision that essentially strips out two of the legs that have been there for 75 years. The other observation is that, yes, this was a textual decision, but I think the flip side of that is when this court looked at the definition of executive, administrative, and professional at the time that this was enacted back in 1938 and used a dictionary definition of what those terms mean, I think he opens a huge can of worms. I think it raises the question of whether or not the current duties test comports with that original sort of reading of what those terms mean. And I think you're going to see people looking very closely at that and trying to see if there is a avenue that will allow plaintiffs to argue that the current duties test, which is very permissive and allows for essentially unlimited non-exempt work under each of those categories, whether or not that will withstand the scrutiny under the test that this judge announced. So that's going to be, I think it's going to be interesting to watch and see how that plays out over time. The final thing, and this goes to an issue about what should employers do at this point, and I don't have any great advice on that, but I would just raise a caution, because we've had a recent experience in which a district court essentially vacated a Department of Labor rule. It was subsequently reversed on appeal. And now the question becomes, what about employers who didn't comply during the period of when the rule was vacated, but was subsequently restored? And we've now seen several district courts who have held, and this is in the home care rule that extended minimum wage and overtime coverage to home care workers. We've seen several district courts that said that the obligation to comply with those obligations go back to the point at which the regulation was to be effective, and that there was no sort of grace period or no amnesty granted to employers during the pendency of that district court's decision that was later overturned. So I think employers need to be very careful and need to take a close look, and they'll make their own decisions about whether or not they think this is likely to survive appeals. But if it doesn't, they may be looking at a fairly substantial back wage obligation if it's vacated. If the Court of Appeals reverses this district court, there's some risk involved for employers. I don't have any great insights. I do think that we on what's going forward, but I do think we're going to see a vigorous and swift effort on the part of the Department of Labor and the current administration to try to get this preliminary injunction reviewed and at least stayed. I think you're going to see a fairly vigorous effort on the part of interveners to try to get into this case, so that the court has a full range of views from interested parties, including employees who would otherwise benefit from this rule. So I think the litigation's about to get messy, and I think we're going to see a lot of activity around this starting now and moving forward in the next weeks and months. So I think that this was really the first salvo in what's going to turn out to be a fairly vigorous and ongoing effort to try to get this reversed, or at least stayed and then reversed. So I think that Lawrence is going to have a lot of work ahead of him to try to defend the decision that this judge entered yesterday. Congratulations, Lawrence. You did outstanding work on this, but I think that it's not going to be the final word. I think there's a fairly good chance that once this gets to the Court of Appeals, even the Fifth Circuit, I think they're going to have a very difficult time saying that the 75-year history of how this exemption has been construed and applied, I think they'll have a difficult time saying that we're going to ignore that 75 years of history and decide that the Department of Labor does not have regulatory authority to decide what an appropriate salary level is. I would only add that through the history of this exemption, there have often been, particularly with the short test that was only really eliminated in 2004, that there have been very high salary levels in order to meet the exemption. And I think there's an argument that essentially we have a short test now, and that argues for a higher salary level than might otherwise be appropriate under a longer test. So I think that we'll see that argued vigorously as well. And again, I think it's going to be difficult to set aside 75 years of history and say that we're operating as if this was passed yesterday and ignore everything that came before. So those are my thoughts, and I'll turn it back to the moderator.
Okay, very good, Michael. Lawrence or Jesse, would you like to add any further points of discussion before we open up the floor to questions?
Yeah, well, Nate, I think, Jesse, if it's all right with you, I think I might, Jesse may want to respond to the compliance issue and how employers might want to look at this. But I thought maybe Michael has some very good comments and very good points, and I thought I might just try to respond to one of them, if that's all right, on the 75 years of history. And obviously that was a big issue. We realized it was a big issue, and one of the things I think that we focused on about that, a key thing, and I think Judge Mazant agreed with us on this, and that is there is 75 years of history of a salary level test, but this really is an approach to the salary level test that is not just a different in degree, but it's different in kind. And I think that really troubled the Judge Mazant, which is why, you know, he talked about how the 4.2 million employees suddenly, a huge number of employees, and the difference between this being a floor to ceiling. And it is true, I think, as Michael points out, it is true that the judge's rationale is a very textualist approach, and it really does seem to indicate that the salary level test is just verboten under the FLSA. But I do think that there is a path. Judge Mazant did leave a footnote saying that he's not necessarily deciding that you couldn't have a salary level test at all. I do think there is a path to sort of where you can thread the needle, so to speak, in this textual approach and recognizing that there's a problem with the salary level test, but that perhaps you could have one that was very low. And that path, I think, is pretty straightforward. You know, as we pointed out to the judge, there has been a salary level test for 75 years, but if you look back at those early cases, it was challenged, not a lot because it was very low, but it was challenged mostly in the context of enforcement proceedings. And it's very interesting because all of the district court judges, essentially, all of the district courts struck it down under the old. Remember, keep in mind, this is pre-Chevron, so there was not a Chevron Step 2 analysis back in those days. And so it's just all the district court judges struck that down under arbitrary and capricious. And finally, there was a Tenth Circuit case, the Yakeley case, where the court said, we're going to uphold this on arbitrary and capricious, but they acknowledged in the Yakeley case, they acknowledged that it was inconsistent with the text. But again, this is pre-Chevron, and so they said, yeah, it's inconsistent with the text of the law, but, you know, it's not so inconsistent as to be arbitrary and capricious. It's a very different kind of analysis than it's done under Chevron Step 2. And this was explained, you know, this was a significant issue of discussion at the hearing. I think ultimately what a court could do is they could say, you can have a salary test, but you can only have a salary level test based really on, you can't have it based on the text of the statute, but you can get there maybe through congressional acquiescence. You know, 75 years is a long time for Congress not to have done something. And that's what the Department of Labor argued. But the problem is if you're going to rely on congressional acquiescence, you got to ask yourself, what did Congress actually acquiesce in? Well, Congress did not acquiesce in a rule like this. I mean, it's very obvious that Congress is very troubled by this rule. Congress acquiesced in a very low rule, a rule that the Department of Labor has repeatedly said was deliberately set in the past so that, quote, and I'm quoting here from either the Stein or one of the old Department of Labor reports, where they said that it's very clear that, quote, an overwhelming majority, end quote, of the people who didn't meet the salary level test also would not meet a duties test. So really the salary level test was seen as sort of a proxy for something that they sort of, the people that clearly wouldn't meet a duties test could be sort of taken off the table by a salary level test. If you believe that Congress acquiesced in that, I think you can have sort of a hybrid approach where you say, you know, the clear text does not allow for a salary test, but Congress has sort of acquiesced in that, but all they've acquiesced in is a very, very low salary test. And so, if that's the analysis you do, then you could say this salary test, which is really different in kind, is one that that Congress did not acquiesce in. It's obviously inconsistent with the clear text, and so this salary test is not allowed by the FLSA. An approach to salary test like has been done here. So I do think there is a path. I think Judge Mazant's opinion is more just relies on the text, but I do think there is a path if we end up in front of the Fifth Circuit, and I only hope that Michael's wrong and that I'm going to be very busy at least tomorrow. I'd like to have Thanksgiving on, so hopefully. But thank you, Mike, for your comments. Very good. Jesse, I don't know if you had any further thoughts.
Yeah, I'll just make two, and I think Michael really puts a fine point on why this ruling was somewhat surprising to those who have been in and around labor regulations for 75 years. The history is long here, and the weight of that on most federal district judges, you would think, would be heavy. But on the other side, you have this textual analysis that has a lot of force to it, and the judge went with that. It is interesting, and I am having had you know, less than 24 hours to really digest this opinion, some trouble reconciling what the court said on page 11, which is Congress intended the EAP exemption to apply to employees doing actual executive, administrative, and professional duties. In other words, Congress defined the EAP exemption with regards to duties, which does not include a minimum salary level. That's in the text on page 11. And then in footnote 2, the court says the court is not making a general statement on the lawfulness of the salary level test for the EAP exemption. So it is a bit difficult to reconcile those two statements. So for now, I guess I'd just go with the rule that, you know, text rules over footnotes. But so that's one point. Two, I would just say in response, you know, what will happen on appeal? Will the Fifth Circuit think that the history matters enough to grant a stay here? And from a legal argument, yes, there's a lot there to be argued, and other parties will surely come in. I will say, just from a practical standpoint, which matters for preliminary injunctions, the equities matter, the irreparable harm matters. For real live businesses on the ground, you know, here in my state of Florida and all across the country, the gymnastics they are now having to engage in over this rule, which many thought was rushed in its implementation, are pretty significant. Many businesses have already positioned themselves to comply. If they now rely on this nationwide exemption to walk back from that, and then sometime next week or more likely the week after, the Fifth Circuit goes the other way, and then perhaps the states or the businesses would go up to the Supreme Court, and it might go another way after a few weeks, and then you have a new administration sworn in at the beginning of January, and they begin regulatory actions or change their litigation positions that could again change what these businesses are doing. All of this occurring not in tandem with any fiscal year or calendar year That is a lot of cost and expense and difficulty to put on businesses and on the workers who may be shifting their job duties and the way they clock in and clock out. And I have to think that the appellate courts will weigh that. That is going to matter. So we'll see. But it's certainly going to be an interesting few weeks in labor law.
Okay, this is Nate. Michael, did you want to respond before we get to audience questions?
I would only, and to that last point, I think that you're right, that there's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing that's going on, and it puts everybody in an awkward place. But I would only say that most of the compliance cost shifting to this new system have already been incurred. Most businesses have already gone through whatever analysis they're doing of their workforce to decide who's exempt and who's not exempt. They've already made decisions about moving employees from salaried to hourly, changed their timekeeping systems, have addressed telecommuting for these workers. Those are costs that have already been incurred. The only thing left is whether or not they're going to be paying a higher salary to workers who are below the 47 and change currently, and instead of converting them to hourly or raising their salary to meet the new threshold. So most of the direct costs have already been incurred. What hasn't been are the transfers from employer to workers. And so I think that's going to be another consideration, is that we're really talking about transfers, not costs, and where do the equities lie there?
And if I may, let me just add one rejoinder to that, Michael. I think for many major, the large-scale employers, yes, they have been gearing up for this and may have done a lot of that work. This rule, and one of the criticisms of it, was that it was so broad. It applies to small businesses, large businesses, nonprofits, governments. My sense is that many out there may not be ready. Many of those who are not as sophisticated may not be ready. And moreover, I'm not certain that the only adjustments businesses made were, well, here's how payroll is going to work from now on, and here's how much more we'll be paying. My sense is that over time, businesses were getting ready to eliminate jobs in response to this. That's what many people feared would be the response to this regulation. And if this injunction will help them save those jobs around the holiday season, I'm not sure that their answer will be to go ahead and implement anyway. Their answer may be, let's save the jobs and hope that the injunction holds. So I think it's probably not a one-size-fits-all in terms of the harm and the logistical implications of this around the country.
Okay, very good. I think given the time left for the call, we should move to audience questions, and we can pick up that discussion later if there aren't any questions, but let's give the audience a chance. I will now open the floor for questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Looks like we already have a couple questions in the queue. Let's proceed with them now.
Hi, my name is Jason Coleman. I'm in Nashville, Tennessee. An issue that y'all thought that it seemed to be a matter of concern for the judge was the large number of people who overnight would go from exempt to non-exempt. And I was just wondering if there was some historical data about what percentage of the workforce fell below the salary threshold when they were, during the various other updates. And I think the last one was sometime in the 70s, and how that compared to what percentage were going to be below the new threshold.
Yeah, so this is Lawrence Mander. I think I can address that because this was an issue that was at the, that was discussed at length at the hearing. That we didn't talk about numbers. The judge would seem to be the one that Judge Mazan seemed the one that was very concerned about the 4.2 million. But what we did talk a lot about was percentages and percentiles. And the reason we did is because the Department of Labor, both in their briefing and at the argument, repeatedly sort of justified the rule or defended the rule as sort of business as usual, in the sense that they said we've always had this sort of cutoff, a cutoff set at the, as you may or may not know, the cutoff is set at the 40th percentile of all salaried workers. So not all EAP salaried workers, but just all salaried workers in the country, and then it's based on the 40th percentile of, I think, the southern region or something, so one of the regions in the country, but it's this 40th percentile number, and the Department of Labor attorneys were saying, well, you know, we've always had a cutoff, and that's about exactly where we've always had the cutoff, even pre-2004 when we had the long and the short duties test. We always had a cutoff at about that level. So essentially, they were saying we've always done it this way. And what we pointed out to the, you know, in our briefing and in a significant portion of our reply brief was dedicated to showing that this is not business as usual. And what's happened is you know, I tried to use the analogy of the frog in the boiling pot, which I'm not sure resonated with Judge Mazan, but so maybe I shouldn't use it on this call. But it's just over time, what's happened is. We've sort of lost the duties test. The duties test is, I guess, become less rigorous, and that's at least the argument that the Department of Labor was making. And so they both in their rule and in this litigation, they justified having this high cutoff because they said, well, since we've got a less rigorous duties test, we've got to have a higher salary cutoff. And then they pointed to and said, well, and also the salary cutoff isn't any higher than it ever was, and they would point to the historical level of the salary test for the short duties test, where the salary level would start for the short duties test. And they said, well, it's historically been approximately at that 40th percentile. What they were ignoring, though, and we made sure the judge realized, was that historically you could still be an EAP employee under their rules if you were under that 40th percentile. You just had to meet a more rigorous duties test. And so you've never until now, until this current rule, had a test where 40% of the salaried employees were just categorically excluded from being able to be an EAP employee based strictly on a salary test. In the past, the cutoff was, you know, in under the old rule, I think it was the 20th percentile, which is why it sort of doubled. I think it's been as low as in the 10th percentile at that, where that very bottom cutoff was, where you couldn't, you weren't able to be an EAP employee based strictly on salary alone. And I think that's what really troubled the judge, is he didn't see this as just, you know, the Department of Labor understandably tried to characterize this as, we're just making a difference, a change that's sort of we're updating the number, et cetera. But we strongly believe, and I think the rule, even in the rule itself, we strongly believe that the rule says that they are taking a very different approach, where they're just using the salary cutoff to categorically exclude a much higher number of employees that otherwise would be eligible, even under something like the old long duties test. And that seemed to me to be the thing that really troubled the judge. And the way he articulated it was, he kept pointing to the 4.2 million number. But so to answer your question, I do think it's you know, we're talking about a 40th percentile, whereas under the 2004 rule, it was the 20th percentile where the cutoff was. And even before that, when you had the long and short duties test, you always had something like the 10th percentile or the 20th percentile. You've never had a number that was so high, where all these people that are under it were just categorically excluded. I'll let Jesse or Michael speak to if my understanding of that is correct.
I think that's correct, but one of the issues that is going to continue is the 2004 rule basically eliminated the long test and instead substituted in its place just the short test, but retained the long test low salary. So you had a disconnect from historical practice, which is, if it's the long test, you can have a lower salary. If you're going to revert to the short test, then we're going to compensate for that easier
duties test by having a higher salary threshold. And I think that there's some logic to, if you're going to eliminate the long test, then you have to make sure that the salary is enough to compensate for the much less rigorous short test that's in its place. Now, obviously, the judge wasn't persuaded by that, but I think there's still a fairly persuasive argument that you can't have it both ways. You can't have an easy duties test and also a low salary, that you have to compensate on one side or the other, either by enhancing the duties test and keeping the low salary, or clinging to the short test and having a higher salary that helps weed out those who otherwise shouldn't be granted the exemption. The other piece of this, and I think it's going to come up again and again, is that there's a sort of a maxim under the FLSA that coverage and protections are broadly construed and exemptions narrowly construed. And that's been true since the courts first took this up back in the 40s, and I think it continues to be true that it's not enough to say that we're going to look at this exemption and we're going to apply it broadly. I think, on the contrary, you look at the exemption and you apply it narrowly, and I don't think the court did it in this case.
Okay, Jesse, I'll just add one thing, and Michael, I think you've well described sort of the state of the law and the flux on it. I would only add this point, as you know, we as lawyers probably on this call, all of us, this is fascinating and interesting. If just think about from the perspective of an HR director, if you are thinking about all of this, short test, long test, shifting over time, the court's injunction, when we talk about regulatory drag on the economy, and what is happening and why we haven't seen wage growth and job growth and GDP growth over the last several years the way we would want. This is what businesses are talking about when they make that point, is that the regulations are so complex and so numerous that they simply cannot, they need an environment of certainty, and they are not operating in one right now. And you have to have a team of lawyers to figure out if you're paying your workers appropriately and how to structure your payroll. And you know, for me, this kind of discussion highlights exactly that.
Okay, gentlemen, all points well taken. We have three callers waiting to ask questions. Let's go to the next caller now.
Yes, this is Jerry Hunter in St. Louis, Missouri. I'd like to ask Solicitor General Van Dyke, on the point you made about the Fifth Circuit could find that the department does have a legal authority to establish a salary test, but just this particular salary test on the rule was not appropriate. How confident are you that the Fifth Circuit would go in that direction? Because obviously, as you know, if the Fifth Circuit are so fine, then there's the chances of the department going to the Fifth Circuit to the Supreme Court is not that great. So how confident are you? And then I'd also like to ask the Solicitor General and Jesse if they want to comment on Michael's point that Michael Hancock's point that the employers have some risk if the employers rely on the nationwide injunction which the district court has issued here, because at some point if the district court is overturned, the employers who didn't comply by December 1st may have some monetary liability. And along those lines, the problem I have with the point that Mr. Hancock made is that for instance here in Missouri, there's a state law that If they implemented the increase on the rule in Missouri, employers would have to give 30 days notice before implementing a wage reduction. So I think that could be problematic in and of itself too.
Well, Jerry, this is Lawrence. Thanks for your question, and I think what I'll do is I'll probably defer to Jesse on the second question you had about the compliance, because that really it's not something that I only play a labor lawyer on TV a little bit. I'm more of a constitutional appeals lawyer, and so the risk of what employers should do, you know, in light of which where this may go, I think is something that maybe Jesse could speak to, or at least maybe nobody can, but certainly Jesse could better than me, perhaps. But as far as the Fifth Circuit, what I think the odds are that it would rely on sort of a congressional acquiescence argument. Let me back up a little bit. First of all, I think some of the points Jesse made earlier, I do think the Fifth Circuit, I think probably Judge Mazon, in the background of all of this, I do think this recent election probably is an elephant in the room that you can't hide. And so I'm not sure how much appetite there's going to be on behalf of the Department of Labor and Department of Justice, who's representing them, to continue fighting this. Some of the other instances where regulations have been struck down, the immigration case and such, the Department of Justice has actually gone to the state attorneys and said, let's just have a stay of litigation until the new administration comes in. I don't know whether that will happen here. I think it's a possibility. But if they do appeal to the Fifth Circuit, I do think that all of the considerations that Jesse mentioned earlier, sort of the soft considerations, those make a difference. I do think all of this will be about nothing if ultimately either through the Congressional Review Act or unwinding this as in the new administration. It might take a long time, but that's got to be a little bit on judges' minds and whether or not they are in haste to undo what the district court judge has done here. I do want to say, though, as to the substance of your question, as far as, first of all, I think the Fifth Circuit, I think we've got it on the Fifth Circuit. There's a lot of judges that are probably like Judge Mazon, that Jesse said, that agree with the legacy of Scalia, would look at the text. And I think the truth is if you look at the text of what the FLSA says, the Chevron Step 1 inquiry, as I've been calling it, it does, and maybe that's why I've got a little different look at this than Jesse and Michael that are obviously longtime labor lawyers. I came and I looked at the text and I said, you know what? This text does not allow a salary level test. And when I looked at the history, I said, you know what? Back in the 40s, the vast majority of judges agreed with that. And the only way that any courts got around that was they relied on a non-Chevron type analysis. So if you're sort of an originalist, textualist type, which I think a lot of the Fifth Circuit judges are, I think you could reach exactly the same conclusion that Judge Mazant did. And what I'm saying is that even if you're not, even there is still another path, I think, that you could get to. So I hate to forecast what the Fifth Circuit would do, but I do agree, I think, with some of the sentiment that's been said, that I do think that I like our chances in the Fifth Circuit, both on the pure textualist approach and also on the congressional acquiescence. I think we have multiple ways that the Fifth Circuit could uphold this, and I think some of the background pressures on this wouldn't fight against that. So that's sort of my, I hope that responds to your question I hate to give percentage. Whenever I give a percentage, when I'm forced to give a percentage, I just give 50%, and that way I'm at least half right. But I think we'd do pretty well in the Fifth Circuit, I think would be my hope. Again, I'll turn it over to Jesse on the if he has any more thoughts on that, and then on the compliance issue as to whether or not what employers should maybe do given the uncertainty, the back and forth, the ping pong that could happen here.
Well, I'll just add, Michael raises a really interesting and difficult point about sort of this retroactive liability if ultimately the state and the chamber were not to prevail in their suits. From a pure just gut reaction, how outrageous that would be if a business is relying properly on a federal court nationwide injunction and then is told, no, in fact, you have this liability, but it's out there, it's an issue. And as I said, I think earlier on this call, there is no broad-based advice that I assume Michael would agree with me on this, that any labor lawyer or otherwise can give right now, you know, on a call like this. It's really going to be client specific. It's going to be about client risk tolerance. It's also going to be about what the client has done so far. They're going to have considerations of morale, of logistics, and of their, again, their risk tolerance to see where this goes. And also what they're, you know, for those employers who simply were going to absorb the cost, maybe pass it through on price, but keep their workforce as is, and implement, maybe they go forward. But for those who were going to make serious adjustments to either the way people work or who gets to continue working, they may have no choice but to rely on this injunction and hope for the best. But Michael may have more to say about the law surrounding the retroactivity.
No, I don't have a lot to add. I just think it's a consideration, as you pointed out, Jesse, that labor lawyers and in-house counsel are going to have to look closely, and they may conclude that they're likely to prevail either in the courts or in Congress and assess the risk as being fairly low. But there's always a risk if you don't move towards compliance and this injunction is vacated, that you have a liability that you hadn't accounted for. So I just think there needs to be a careful analysis of that and the risk involved and decisions made accordingly.
Okay, we are running short on time, but we do have two callers waiting patiently, and I want to make sure we get to their questions, so let's do that. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, my name is Libby Sobek. I'm calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I am wondering, Jesse, you talked a lot about the Congressional Review Act, but I'm wondering if there are actions that President-elect Trump can take once he's in office outside of the litigation concerns that you've discussed today about that it's likely going to get messy. What can Trump do once he's president to affect the rule or make this non-regulatory anymore?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, so let's assume there was no lawsuit, or that the lawsuit, that the injunction had not been granted. Because it is maybe inside the CRA window, that is one of the easiest, cleanest thing for the new administration and Congress to do would be for a majority, I assume, you know, a bare majority of the Senate and then a larger majority of the House to pass a resolution of disapproval or repeal or however they'll phrase it, and President Trump would sign it. That is the cleanest, easiest way. The other thing that can be done, this is now a published rule in the Federal Register. The only way for the Labor Department to pull back on that is to open up a new round of notice and comment rulemaking and go through all of the process that's required and then promulgate a new rule that can take months. And then, of course, that rule, just like this rule was subject to challenge, now you will have the labor groups and others come and challenge that new rule. And when agencies do a complete about-face, that is often looked at with a jaundiced eye by courts. And so there's a real challenge there. In fact, one of the claims that Solicitor General Van Dyke has brought is that on the elevator clause, which we haven't talked a lot about, that was a complete about-face for the Department of Labor. And I think ultimately that's why many people felt that piece would get struck. So the reversal by the Labor Department is not a sure thing. The third thing the Trump administration could do is not enforce. They could refuse to take enforcement actions, but of course that is controversial. We've seen that in the Obama administration with respect to immigration and marijuana laws and other things. The non-enforcement of existing rules and laws is controversial. And there are plaintiff suits that are still civil suits that are available to enforce FLSA requirements. So even if USDOL doesn't enforce, private actions can enforce. And then the last thing the administration could do is in this ongoing litigation, depending on how it goes, they could concede error, they could pull back. If the injunction stays, they could ask the federal district court in Texas to proceed to summary judgment, enter it on these same legal grounds, and then not appeal. So there are a variety of options, but none of them are as clean as a congressional repealer sometime, you know, as soon as possible using the Congressional Review Act.
Okay, gentlemen, as it turns out, that is our last caller of the day. I want to give you a minute, though, if you'd like to make some concluding remarks. Or have we covered it all? Michael, would you? Is there anything else?
I'll cede back my time. Thank you.
Yeah, I think thank you very much for having us on, Nate, and this is Lawrence, and I don't really have any more comments. I don't think so.
And this is Jesse, and I just want to thank you, Nate, and the Federal Society, and Michael and Lawrence, and wish everyone a very happy Thanksgiving.
Very good. Just a programming reminder to our audience to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleform calls, and also to check the full schedule of upcoming calls on our website, fedsoc.org. You can also find previously recorded calls there as podcasts. On behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank all of our experts today for their time and expertise. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.